You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Max Doty. He's the author of a new novel that I literally couldn't stop reading until the end. It's titled The House That Eats the Dead. You can catch Max in person on August 18th from 7 to 8 p.m. at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland. Welcome to the Exchange, Max.
Thanks so much for having me.
Many of your fans know you as Scary Max on Reddit's No Sleep Forum. How did that community influence your voice as a writer?
Oh, well, I think if you look at the kind of hallmarks of No Sleep, I guess, first of all, it's something that has to grab your attention immediately because you're competing with all of the other noise on the internet, that kind of like 10-second attention span that like the typical internet user might have. So I feel like with my stories, you know, this is a haunted house book, but it's not the kind of haunted house book that holds all its secrets until that final reveal. We're going real fast into the kind of excitement of it, and it's kind of starts fast and stays fast all the way until the end.
It certainly does. What was it like to see your stories consistently hit the top of the charts there?
I would say it's equal parts exciting and nerve-wracking because with every new story I would put out, you know, I started at the bottom where I would just get maybe 50 people reading something, and that's great, but you would look up at those top stories getting a million reads or something and want to be there. And then finally, as I kind of like figured out what was working, what fans responded to, I was able to kind of consistently get to the top of those charts. And I will say like the journey up is more fun than trying to stay up. And like it's exciting when you're like, I did better than the last story. People are really starting to read. And then when you're at the top, it's almost like you have this expectation for yourself that everything's going to be a hit, and it just can't be. There's going to be misses. You know, I'm sure even Stephen King writes some duds and just he has the luxury of probably just putting them in the drawer. And when you're on public display on the internet and you're publishing essentially everything, everyone sees your failures.
Well, there's trial and error on the way up. But once you're there, everyone wants you to be perfect.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, no one is. So I think, you know, I just sort of gave myself permission to fail when I was doing that. I would essentially like write something late at night after all my kids went to sleep and pretty much just publish it, hit the publish button on Reddit right away without giving myself that chance to say, wait, is this good enough? No, it was just like, nope, off it goes. And then on to the next one tomorrow. And if this was a dud, then the next one will be great.
So you let the crowd guide you.
I think I learned a lot just from, yeah, that kind of trial and error. There's like this kind of story I like to tell where, and this is probably a made up story, but there's this woodshop teacher and he has two groups of students and he tells them, group A, you guys are going to build a new birdhouse every single day of my class. So when you get here, you start building a birdhouse. Group B, you have all semester to build a perfect birdhouse and you can take as much time as you want. And at the end of the semester, he looks, and according to this story, all of the best birdhouses are from group A because they have done that trial and error process, you know, 12th day of building a birdhouse. They have figured it out and they build a great birdhouse. And that perfect birdhouse group never gets it because they're just sanding some imperfect thing that they built on the first day.
Okay, well, you've been building birdhouses for a while because your background is incredibly diverse with a degree from Stanford and Arizona State. How did that academic path lead you into the world of horror writing?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I definitely think at that stage of my life, I had aspirations to be more of a literary writer. I spent like a summer retracing Jake Barnes's steps. He's the protagonist of The Sun Also Rises by Hemingway. And I went all over France and Spain, and I was going to write some kind of travelogue about it. You know, I had a pretentious phase, essentially. But you know, in parallel to that, I was always just a horror fan. Like when I was a kid, I would be digging through boxes of comic books at the shop looking for horror comics. And middle school, I was reading a bunch of Christopher Pike and R.L. Stine novels and just kind of kept graduating. So I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when you're in academia, you have this academic interest. And I'm really thankful that I got, you know, this awesome background and say, like, you know, a class on modernism or postmodernism and having those influences and, you know, pushing myself to read contemporary Nobel Prize winners. And like that piece is there, but there's this parallel kind of passion for horror that I've always had. And I think, you know, writing this book, that literary piece is kind of there. And it's like, I think people who just like literature in general, there'll be something to find in this book. It's not just for horror fans. Like, I think there's that more like kind of upmarket literary piece is there.
So let's talk about the novel, The House That Eats the Dead. Like I said, I literally stayed up all night reading this book. I could not put it down. How would you describe it?
Well, I guess, you know, plot-wise, this is about a couple that moves into a house and they quickly realize that eats the dead, as the title says. And the dead is kind of nebulous. Okay, not nebulously defined. I would say it's actually very concretely defined. It could be a dead piece of wood, like your wooden furniture. That's something dead. It'll eat that. It could be a dead body, and it could eat like a dead dog or a dead person that you bring into the house. And that would be enough to be a horrifying book. But we've added this other piece, which is that when it eats something, it erases it from existence. And the only people that remember it ever existed are the couple that owns the house, Tom and Claire. And once they kind of realize their house has this power, they kind of start spinning and thinking, what can we do with this?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Max Doty, author of the new horror novel, The House That Eats the Dead. Max will be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland on August 18th from 7 to 8 p.m. Now, Max, in the book, Claire moves her family from a declining San Francisco suburb, and she moves to a fresh start.
Yeah.
And there's this contrast between the urban struggle and the suburban dream as the setup. Tell me about that.
With Claire, I wanted a character who's in some ways sympathetic and in some ways almost like, I guess you're constantly comparing yourself to her and wondering, would I act the same way in her shoes? So, you know, that's, you live in, say, a community that's struggling. Like, is it the right thing to do to leave it and just get a fresh start for your family? Or should you be trying to stay and make things better? In a way, like, I think in that first choice she makes is one of selfishness. It's like she can take her family and go to this very expensive house in the suburbs. She's someone who grew up extremely poor and then married into money. So in a way, this is kind of like the last step on that journey from the kind of like blue collar traumatic childhood to this like perfect Instagram life.
And there's a contrast with her sister.
Now her sister, yeah, actually had a chance to date this guy that she ended up with, Tom. But the sister said, no thanks. She passed Tom on to Claire. And the sister has kind of stayed. She's, you know, waitressing, barely getting by, living in like the cheapest apartment in the entire peninsula. And so you can see the sister's almost this kind of like other version of what Claire might have turned out like if she hadn't married her husband.
Right. So was there a specific moment in your own life where a familiar space, something that was safe, that you felt safe in, suddenly felt strange or even dangerous?
I think, you know, a lot of like the genesis of this house probably goes back to the pandemic and the way space has changed during that period for me and I think for most people. You know, you live in this house, and if you're just going about your normal life, you might go to work or the coffee shop. You take the kids to school. You know, you go to a friend's place. Like, the house is maybe what? The place where you sleep, you spend a few hours a day. Suddenly you're in this house 24 hours a day and the walls are closing in. So I think we all went through that kind of like haunting process or the nature of a home completely changed for all of us when it became our bubble.
You know, it's interesting because people have a relationship with their homes.
Absolutely, yeah. I think my wife in particular anthropomorphizes so many objects in our life, like the car, the house. I think we just really grow these bonds, especially with like cars and houses. They almost become these extensions of our physical bodies. And like, I think weirdly, like, yeah, if something happens to your house, like you kind of feel it in a way you wouldn't if it was just some other random physical object in the world. And I think cars, too. I think that's why people get so mad in car accidents and road raging and all that stuff. Because it really, the car, the house, you're so inhabited in those places that they become these extensions of the physical body.
And what's interesting is that even if you have multiple people living in a home, they each have a different relationship with that house.
Yeah, that's certainly true in this book. And I think the house, it kind of it speaks to each family member in The House That Eats the Dead in a different way. And for example, with the teenage son, it's kind of eating away at the books he's reading and spelling words out for him. With the little daughter, it kind of eats the organic paint on the ceiling, creating sparks and showing her little fireworks shows to kind of connect with her. And Claire and Tom have their own ways of hearing and being in dialogue with the house. I think in real life, we all relate to our homes in different ways. And I kind of wanted to take that and magnify it to the nth degree.
And we all have those jumpy moments when things go bump in the night.
Yes. There's certainly more bumps in the book than there are in real life, I hope. You know, I guess during the pandemic, moved back here to Ashland from the Bay, and we'd been in a little condo. And now, you know, we're in a bigger space here, old house that like creaks and groans. And I'm sure those creaks and groans made it into the book too, yeah.
Now, you've had significant success in different mediums. You've had a screenplay that won a Netflix award. Tell me about that.
This was, getting to be about 20 years ago now, which makes me feel old. But I had written a short story about this guy. He was like a little brother of some football players. This kind of loosely inspired by some things that happened here in Ashland. Anyway, I wrote this short story. A friend had gone to USC film school and loved it. And together we wrote a screenplay. And then we entered this contest sponsored by Netflix. And kind of from there, everything went crazy. We had to film a trailer. And then the trailer made it to this sort of top 10. And then we were getting everyone we knew to vote for our trailer on this internet site. And we got picked, and then they gave us a budget, something like $500,000 bucks, and my partner, the director, shot it. And yeah, that's called Almost Kings. That's out, you know, on Amazon and stuff. Now, I will say, I wrote it 20 years ago. The House That Eats the Dead is the new thing that I just did, and it's so much better. So I at least feel good that I've gotten better with age. So well,
tell me about shifting between those mediums.
I have really enjoyed the slowness that comes with writing a book, even though I think probably this book is going to feel super fast to the average reader. But, you know, compared to a screenplay that passes in 2 hours, you can slow down and take more time to develop the characters. There's just so much more interiority and thoughtfulness that happens in a book. I mean, no, you're not going to get away in a movie with just like a long monologue about someone's thoughts or childhood. You have to be showing everything. In a book, you know, you can be in the middle of a crazy action scene and suddenly your character starts thinking about their childhood cat that got run over by a semi or whatever. And you could cut to that. And if you've done it right, the reader will stick with you, hear those thoughts, and then we'll be back in the present moment. Like, you just can't do those same things across mediums.
Who's your favorite character in this book?
Ooh. I mean, to me, I think if it was a movie and I was listing the characters and the actors playing them, I feel like the house would be one of the top billed characters. I don't know. I guess there would be no actor credited with it. But I feel like the house is a real presence that lurks and really feels like a real character in the book, even though it's only shown a bit opaquely through Claire's point of view.
Well, it's interesting because the house makes decisions.
Yeah, the house is kind of, it really depends how you view the book. There's definitely a view where the house is kind of helpful and helping Claire get what she wants. Or you could see it as the house is manipulating her into the house getting what it wants. And I hope that kind of spurs some lively discussion of people who read it. And, you know, same with all the characters. Is it the house's desire or is that coming from inside the character and the house is merely facilitating it?
Ooh. And then there's that playfulness between Claire and the house.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's almost like, you know, you hear these stories about, like, say, someone with their beloved cats, and then they die and the cats eat them. And I guess I kind of had that thought with this book, which is that I do think that House, like, really likes Claire and is trying to work with her and have a kind of a symbiotic relationship. But then you kind of have the sense that if something were to happen to her, she'd be on the dinner plate. Yeah.
Okay, with that, we're going to take a short break. I'll be right back with Max Doty, author of the new horror novel, The House That Eats the Dead. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Now, Max, the house has a very specific, insatiable appetite. How did you develop the rules for the house?
Oh, that's a good question. I guess I should start by saying I don't think the house has rules so much as it has desires and appetites. And, I mean, even I think something as simple as like bringing in a hamburger to the house, I think most days they would eat that hamburger. But there might be that one day where it just doesn't feel like it and the hamburger just kind of sits in the pantry. And I think that anyone who's had a pet kind of knows that. Like you have certain expectations, like you call the pet's name, it's going to come over, or you get their favorite food, that pet will eat it. One day it might be sick, though, or just feeling grumpy, and it's not going to be exactly the same. So that said, I didn't want it to feel like total chaos and just like anything could happen on any page. So, you know, I think, A of all, it just wants to eat, and it wants to especially eat meat. And I guess among meats, probably people most of all. So that was kind of like a guiding light for me. And then the second is I think it does want, in a way, it wants to bond with probably one person above all others. Like I think it's constantly working on its relationship with every family member, with Tom, with Claire, and with the kids, and trying to figure out who's going to be the best kind of partner for me to make sure I stay well fed.
Okay, when you say partner... That's very interesting because in a lot of horror films, mm-hmm. you expect the horrible people mm-hmm. to be horrible.
Sure.
And so there's this expectation, you know, the monster is going to roar and that's it. These terrible, horrible entities are one-dimensional. Mm. This house isn't. This house is multifaceted.
That's true. I feel like the house is more akin to kind of like a pet tiger that you think you know that you can trust it, but it might have a bad day every once in a while. And I think there's a fair amount of work in the horror genre that is, like if you look at most, say, zombie movies or shows, the zombies are out there. You know there's this almost like a force of nature that is constantly having to be dealt with. But most of those movies and shows eventually turn into people versus people. And mm-hmm. it's more about in a crazy situation where the rules are different, how do people react? And so I think that's kind of what we're examining here. We have this marriage, especially between Tom and Claire, and they're constantly kind of like reevaluating this relationship and the power dynamics at present there. And now suddenly when... uniquely, just the two of them are the only people who can remember everything they're erasing. How does that affect their relationship and those power dynamics? So, yeah.
Well, it's very interesting because the house is, as you said, in need of a partner. Mm. The house can't go find its own food. Someone has to feed it.
Yeah, the house has to kind of call in help. Yeah, almost like a Venus flytrap, right? Can't go out on hunting expeditions. They have to count on, I guess for them, the insects just fly in. There's parts of the book that kind of hint that the house has a way of kind of calling in people to try and come into it. And I think that's part of its power too.
And the kind of people it calls is interesting.
It seems to be able especially to call, it calls people that are potential food or feeders for it. So I think, for example, when it goes on the market, the couple has an open house, and it's not like the kind of nice families you're hoping to get at an open house. Right. It is a bunch of very creepy, creepy fellas yeah. Who are kind of eyeing the house and makes you never want to have an open house of your own again.
That threw me off. I've been to a few open houses. That threw me off.
I think part of the genesis of that is kind of like you know, in a horror novel, typically the characters make stupid decisions and pay for it. You know, if you had a house that was haunted, the first thing you would probably think is we should sell this house and get out of here. So part of that is just my writer's mind thinking, how do I throw up roadblocks that we can't? It's not so easy to do that. And the idea is if you have this haunted house that you know can erase people from existence, but you think about who you're selling it to, who's going to take over from here, can you morally justify, you know, selling this house with these powers to someone who might seriously misuse them? Anyway, I wanted to kind of constantly be presenting Claire with these moral quandaries and making it a little harder for her.
Oh, there's so many ironies in all of that. My guest is Max Doty, author of the new horror novel, The House That Eats the Dead. Max will be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland on August 18th from 7 to 8 p.m. So tell me, what does a typical writing day look like for you?
Oh, man. Okay, well, I guess the first part of that is I have four kids, and the oldest is 10, and the youngest is 9 months old.
So, you're busy.
We're busy, and, you know, luckily now we'll have three at school in the fall. And my wife is great about stepping up and giving me time to write. But honestly, a lot of my writing is kids go to bed, I get those 2 hours to, like, really grind it out. And then I think the other thing is, I think when people think of writing, they think of someone sitting in a chair and tapping on the keyboard. I think a lot of what I'm doing is all through the day as I'm just going about my business, just the gears in my head are turning and solving problems and thinking what's next. So that for me, it would be crushing to get those 2 hours and not get a word in. You know, I want to be ready. So through the day, when I'm going, I'm thinking all day about what to be doing. And then I use those 2 hours very, very well.
Well, I want to talk about that just for a second, that part where writers get stuck. They sit down and there's nothing there. Have you ever found yourself in this low imaginative state?
Yeah. I mean, that happens to everyone. I am someone who now tries to go into new work with an outline, and at least for the big stuff. But inevitably, there'll be parts where you get stuck. And you can just do things like jump to a later scene that you do know what's going to happen, something like that. Sometimes, you know, maybe you just need to go on a long walk and really have a think with yourself and try and get unstuck. I talk to my wife about story problems. You know, I sometimes just give up and read maybe. But, I mean, a robust outline is probably the best, you know, prevention for writer's block. And I now, as I've gotten older and wiser, go into my novels with one of those.
How much of you and your wife is in this book?
Gosh, you know, I feel like we're both a lot in there. I wrote this book, I had quit my gaming job and kind of taken on the role of full-time dad, spent most of my time with, I think my son was 2 or 3 at the time. And so a lot of my days were spent, you know, like Claire's like, she's essentially been assigned the domestic role. Tom is the worker bee. And so
he's an attorney.
He's sort of an attorney at like a venture capital fund, and he's kind of like hoping to rise to become an executive. He's very driven. And I've been there too. I've been an executive at a gaming company. So has my wife. And so we've explored that aspect of ourselves where you're like in that corporate world. We've both taken turns where we're more on the domestic front. I like to think we're a really, really good team and support each other. In a way, this is almost like imagining like the dark side of like, what if we were both, you know, 100% more ruthless? And what would that look like?
This novel is a little more than 300 pages long. And I'm wondering how much material was left out during the editing process?
I know that probably the majority of writers overwrite and then reduce. But I'm actually a different breed, which is that I underwrite and then I add. So that probably helps me get the through line of plot in a good way for myself. But probably my first draft is maybe 45,000 words long. And as I went through revisions, my wife and my agent were both saying, you know, why don't we add a little more here? Can we find out more about the teenage son? Can we find out more about the kindergarten daughter? Okay, yeah, I can add a chapter here, add a chapter there. And before I knew it, I had a full-length book of, you know, I think it's 85 or 90,000 words. So the thing had almost doubled by the time all that editorial was done. But yeah, it definitely wasn't from taking out anything. It was the final product was more additive, I guess, from a skeletal rough draft.
Did you know the ending, or did you have multiple endings?
Oh, man. You know, it's so funny. I think there were times where I truly considered five different people as a sort of final villain reveal. And I really thought about all of them and then kind of decided on the one that I thought made the most sense thematically.
So the release of The House That Eats the Dead is when?
Is on the 18th. So same day as the Bloomsbury event. It'll be out everywhere in the United States. It comes out in the UK on the 13th, so a little before.
Tell me about this experience as a horror writer versus your gaming experience and your screenplay experience.
Oh, yeah. Each one's been so unique. Well, like I kind of told you the story of the screenplay experience, and I mean, that was really fun. You know, the good and bad of movie making for a writer is at some point it's in someone else's hands, and that was my partner, Phil Flores, who directed it. And so I had this kind of weird magical feeling of you write it. I think I got to go visit the set where they were shooting one day, and then just a few months later, like a kind of a DVD showed up in the mail and I got to watch the movie. And there's this sort of weird magical feeling of something that was in your brain is suddenly on a TV screen in front of you. The bad part is like you cede all control to the director. And that was a friend, and I think he did an awesome job. I could imagine you hear horror stories of writers who write something and it is nothing like the story they wrote when they see that movie.
And you were in the gaming industry, and that's about storytelling too.
Yeah, the games I worked on were sort of like choose your own adventure books on your phone. We had a platform similar to sort of Netflix, and 60 or 70 books, all in different genres. And I was the head writer for this. So that was a cool experience because it was just every day, you know, one day I'm giving notes on a romance book, then a horror book, a thriller, you know, mystery. We covered every genre. In the end, it was a ton of romance because that was what was really succeeding on that platform. So now it's really different pivoting from giving a lot of notes on some kind of steamy romance books to kind of doing what I really, really want to be doing, writing this horror book.
Okay, so in our final minute, what's next for Scary Max?
For Scary Max, I will actually be posting some new short stories on Reddit. It's a kind of cross-promotion with House That Eats the Dead. And if anyone wants to check out my back catalog on Reddit, it's up there. There's probably 70 fun short stories. They're all kind of bite-sized, 2,000 or 3,000 words apiece. Scary Max with two X's. Okay. And then in a year from now, a second book will come out. It's another horror book, kind of a similar vein, but not a sequel. It'll be sort of exploring the artificial extension of life and some of the consequences of that.
The artificial extension of life.
Yeah, I kind of like to tackle these big ideas. This one is a lot about memory and relationships, power dynamics. This is kind of about, the artificial extension of life. I can't say too much yet, it'll be a good read. And I think people who like this one will like that one too.
Okay, well, I can't wait. You kept me up all night for this one, so I guess I'll have to expect another all-nighter when
next one early in the morning, so you'll have a better day.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. That's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining me, and congratulations on this new book.
I really appreciate you having me. Thank you so much, and thanks for reading.
My guest was Max Doty, author of the new horror novel, The House That Eats the Dead. Max will be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland on August 18th from 7 to 8 p.m. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.